Okay, I think enough about that. We'll do an AC to first now. Now, the clue for today is the Salaika on effacement number 8, I believe. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutan dhamman sankham namassami. So the Salaika Sutta on effacement. To understand what Salaika means, it does literally mean scratching out. The Laika, as I was mentioning about 2 or 3 weeks ago, you may remember, is a word for a secretary. And the reason is it's for the word for writing, when they would actually scratch out grooves in palm leaves, put some ink in there, rub off the surface, and the ink will be in the grooves, and that's where we got the palm leaf manuscripts from. And so scratching was the word for lighting. And this is actually scratching something out, like wiping, cleaning something out. That's what Salaika is. And it's obviously what we're talking about here is scratching out the defilements, things like greed, hatred and delusion, and the other of, another ways of looking at the greed, hatred and delusion defilements in terms of fetters and sanyojanas. And you can see here that the context was there were some monks with Mahachunda who had some really good meditation. They were confusing their meditation attainments with attainments on the path. And it's very easy to do that. That sometimes you get into very deep meditation and you think, wow, I'm enlightened, I'm a streamwind or something else. And the Buddha's actually making a very strong point here that no, you've got to be very careful here, because the attainments, even in the deepest of these jhanas, they can be temporary. It's not really the scratching out yet. You're getting pretty close, but you haven't really effaced and taken away these things. And right at the very end, it's one of the very, very famous quotes, which is, I'm going to focus on at the very end, about the simile of the person standing in the mud. We use that very often, especially in Theravada, to say that the idea of an unenlightened bodhisattva helping people, it doesn't make sense according to the Buddha's teaching. So we'll come up to that in a few moments. So here we go. Thus have I heard Salaika Sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove in Atapinika's park. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Mahachunda rose from meditation and went to the Blessed One. Usually the monks after the meal, they would go into their day's abiding, display by themselves, meditate or take a rest, whatever. And usually in the evening they may congregate together to listen to some Dhamma. But just usually the most of the day they were by themselves in solitude. When it was evening, the Venerable Mahachunda rose from meditation, went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he sat down at one side and said to him, and you can see at one side, and he was sitting in front of the teacher, voice to one side, said to him, Venerable Sir, various views arise in the world associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world. Now, does the abandoning and relinquishing of those views come about in a bhikkhu who is attending only to the beginning of his meditative training? Chunda, as those various views that arise in the world associated either with the doctrine of a self or with doctrines about the world, if the objects in relation to which those views arise, especially where they come from, which they underlie, and which they are exercised upon, is seen as actually is with proper wisdom thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then the abandoning and relinquishing of those views comes about. So this is very clearly the attainment of the stream winner, where one gets one's right view of the Dhamma. And in particular here, the doctrines of a self, the doctrines about the world, if you want to look at all of those, the Brahmajala Sutta has them listed. And this is where we start to think, is that the world eternal, or is it the self, is there really a self, is it really eternal, is this world created by a God? These are all those sorts of views and theories, the religious dogmas which arise in the world. And if anyone wants to have a look about the view of a self of a citta being permanent, everlasting, that is wrong view number 8 in the Brahmajala Sutta. So you can check it out yourself. So those are like the views and doctrines, dogmas about the self and the world. And this is actually the job of the first path, and fruit of stream winning, is actually to seeing, especially, to see the impermanence, suffering, non-self, insubstantiality of the five candles, and there's nothing outside of those five candles. So this is, how do you get to stream winning, basically? How can you scratch out these defilements of a belief that somewhere, some place, there can be a self, a me, even like a cosmic consciousness or some ephemeral sort of consciousness which is unbounded, ungrounded, the ground of all being or something else, some way that you can hang a hat of a self on so you can live happily ever after. Those are the sort of doctrines of the self. Now how can those be overcome? And he says, only by proper wisdom. And actually basically seeing all of these things, the things which these ideas are based on. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not a self. So whatever your views are based on, maybe your perceptions of life, all the perceptions, even what you're having now, what we call, what some people call bare experience, bare knowing. If that's what your views are based on, to see even this bare knowing is not me, not mine, not a self. It doesn't belong to me. Just a process, that's all. If all these things are upon your thoughts, which is what most people base their views and their dogmas on, you think it out and it all makes sense to you. Even that, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. So anything which these things on, it's from your experience, your perception, your thoughts, throw them all away. So you've got nothing to base anything left on. Then, so you see, all this is not me, not mine. So, first of all, the Buddha, and when we have these suttas, it becomes quite clear, but why did the Buddha put it this way and not the other way? He starts off with talking about the eight attainments. And again, as Ajahn Chah would say, it's not attainments, it's the eight letting goes. But nevertheless, people call them attainments. The jhanas and immaterial states. It is possible here, Chanda, that quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, which are the five images, that some bhikkhu enters upon a vice in the first jhana, which is accompanied by the movement of the mind onto the object, and keeping on the object, that's the vitaka vichara, with the rapture and pleasure born of that seclusion from the five senses. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement. What it really means is that I've got rid of things. But it's not these attainments that are called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called pleasant abidings in this life. And so I make plenty of changes there for the translation. Here and now, sanditika means in this life. And they're called pleasant abidings in this life. And you see, each of the other of these jhanas and immaterial states are also called pleasant abidings in this life. And that's always the definition of pleasant abidings here and now, pleasant abidings in this life. So elsewhere, whenever you see this word in the suttas, pleasant abiding here and now, you know it's a metaphor, it's a euphemism, it's the same synonym for one of the jhanas. So it's interesting to know that, because when you know just how these words, what they actually mean, and how they're used, sometimes they're called jhanas, sometimes they're called pleasant abiding here and now, you know they mean the same thing. It makes the Dhamma much clearer.
There are other words that are more sort of powerful than pleasant. Why is pleasant used for such a powerful state?
Why it's used for powerful state is because it's the only real pleasant abiding which you can have in this life. The body sucks, it hurts, you get sick. You know, during my retreat I had a lovely time but I had a very sore back. I tell somebody today about that. But the body was really hurting. But if you're not hurting, you get stomach aches, you get stuff from hay fever. I'm getting old. And the older you get, the more aches and pains you get. And this body sucks. And so the only pleasant abiding you have is actually to get into deep meditation. That's what even all the Buddha said. So the only real time you get away from the dukkha of old age and having an old body is when you're in sort of the deep meditation. That's why it's called a pleasant abiding. You don't have a pleasant abiding when you're sitting after the meal talking to all these people. That's not a pleasant abiding. You have a pleasant abiding when you're sitting here reading out great suttas. That's work.
What I think was not pleasant. You could graduate that word.
Oh yes, but these are the pleasures which are allowed for people on the path. The Vairagya Sutta distinguishes between two types of pleasure. The pleasure of the world, which is hina, which is low, gamo, which is of the world, potujaniko, the putujanas. And that pleasure should be avoided. And that's the pleasure of the five senses. Pleasure of the mind. So that is a pleasure you can indulge in. So that leads to enlightenment. So these are the pleasant abidings. The Buddha called them pleasant abidings because it's a pleasure which is allowed. That's first dharma. It's not effacement. You can't just rely upon that and think that's enough. And you obviously know my teachings, it's important, it's essential, but it's not enough. It's possible here that with the stilling of a quiet and sustained movement of the mind, onto the source, there's no thinking in these jhanas. Some mind enters upon the bias in the second jhana, which has self-confidence, and not self-confidence in those self things, like it's a confidence in the object, so you don't have to hold it. And singleness of mind, because you're not moving at all now, without any movement, with rapture and pleasure born of this stillness, this what here called samadhi. You might think, thus, I'm abiding in effacement, but this is not effacement, this is called another pleasant abiding in this life, in the noble one's discipline. It's possible here that with the fading away, as well as the fading away of rapture, of the pity, some monk abides in equanimity. Mindful and fully aware, still, I always mention this, mindful and fully aware, because sometimes people think the jhanas are trances, you're not mindful. You're mindful and fully aware. Still feeling pleasure, not with the physical body, but pleasure with this state, sukha, you enter upon the abiding in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce they have a pleasant abiding again, who has equanimity and is mindful. You might think, no, so I'm abiding in effacement, but this is the third jhana, it's called a pleasant abiding in this life. It's not called effacement. It's possible here with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, the disappearance of joy and grief, this is the disappearance of the pleasure and pain of the five senses, that's the pleasure and the pain, the dukkha sukha here. And the joy and grief here, samanasa dhammanasa, literally means just that happiness and joy in the sixth sense, the mental sense. So no more pleasure or pain in any of the six senses. So totally without pleasure, totally without pain, totally equanimous, just in the sixth sense. So Martha Pentapon enters upon the bias in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to this equanimity. You might think, thus I am abiding in effacement, but it is not these attainments that are called effacement in the noble one's discipline. These are called pleasant abidings in this life, in the noble one's discipline. Now you get to the immaterial attainments. It is possible, and just to note, these are never called jhanas in the suttas. These are called immaterial attainments. Jhanas are jhanas, these are just immaterial states, usually not attainments. It is possible here with a complete samadhi of perceptions of form, with a disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perception of diversity, aware that space is instead of infinite, I like unmeasured. Some might enter upon abide in the base of unmeasured space. You might think, thus I'm abiding in effacement, but it's not in these attainments that are called effacement in no one's discipline. These are called peaceful abidings in the no one's discipline. You may understand, if you've read my explanation of these states in the book which I wrote, that even in like mathematics, you know, the infinity is very close to zero. This means it's literally is unmeasurable. You can't sort of measure infinity. You can only just point to it and get close to it. But the experience which I use to get people to understand what these states are, when you have present moment awareness, really in this moment, you know, between all past and all future, you're right bang in the middle of now, then there's no time at all, there's no extension there, it's zero time. But when you enter those states, it's also the experience you have, many people say this, it's like time is infinite. You have all the time in the world now. It's almost like you're free of time. And that's very similar to the experience of these other states here. You know, if you look at planet one way, there's just no time there at all. Here there's no space left. No sort of extension. No sort of way of measuring a size of an experience or a limit or whatever. But it's like a zero point. The perception of space is vanishing. As it vanishes, it goes to this infinite, but at the same time it means the whole thing disappears. Like infinite time you experience in the present moment, but also no time. Because time is about to disappear. It's the impact of the mind. Sensory impact means nothing is moving, nothing is impacting upon you. So things are just disappearing. There's no... That's a good expression. Like you're sitting in your hut and there's no sounds impacting upon you.
Yeah, sure, but there it is, like from the transition from the fourth child to the material.
This is sixth sense.
Okay.
Not five sixth sense. Five sense is all five.
So there's no sixth sense impact in the material thing.
That impact is still. So it's not impacting upon you anymore. There's no change. Yeah, that's how I would interpret that. Okay. Just the same as, you know, if there's no growth sort of impacting upon you, then your sense of sound disappears. It vanishes. So basically the mind is sort of creating new sensory impressions to keep that sort of safe space active. It's turning off. Make sense?
It just sounds strange because it's shallow and so stable and still. What kind of diversity and sensory impact?
Okay.
Especially diversity, what kind of diversity?
Yeah. Okay, the diversity of that fourth jhana will be the fact that there is a sense of perceiving that, the experience of that is still is that rather than the other. That's the only diversity you might have there, the sense of. But that's only one way of looking at it. What really is happening over there is that you are so still, and because of the stillness, things are about to disappear. So this is the stages of the disappearing of consciousness. This is the mind turning off. And the only way it can turn off is because there's nothing there to excite it, to impact upon it, to keep it going. It's like the only way you can go to sleep at night is people stop poking you. If, you know, if someone was in your room, they kept poking you, impacting you. The sound is like that. Sometimes there might be a mosquito sort of bites you and it impacts on you, and that sort of wakens up the mind again. You don't fall asleep. So you need that sensory impact for you to arouse that sense. So the mind now has no mental impact. Actually to arouse the mind. So it's just idling and it's just turning off, turning off, turning off, turning off. Maybe another way of looking at it, because I was went to the retreat centre this morning to check the computer here, and I went outside to talk to Kamali about something or other. When I went back, the screen was black. So apparently if you don't move the mouse, I do things after a while, everything stops, and that's pretty similar. So when you don't use any mouse in the fourth jhana, everything is still, you know, the screen's going to go blank and you wouldn't turn off.
So what about awareness?
Awareness is disappearing. Where is the peak of mindfulness? Where is the summit of mindfulness? In the fourth jhana. This is the purity of mindfulness. This is its fullness. From there on, it starts to vanish. Yeah, very much so. That's why I think it's in the Mahavaita Sutta, was it Chudaveta? There's also a difference between someone being dead and someone in the state of cessation of perception of feeling.
And the consciousness is completely detached.
Yeah. And that's actually very interesting, because the only difference is the wall of the body. If I remember that correctly, I think it's true. Which means that if you do get into that state of another perception of another perception of full cessation, the only way you can tell whether you know you're dead or whether you're in a deep meditation is your body doesn't get cold. Oh no, just this is the cessation of perception of feeling.
What about that guy who like shifted into deep meditation and then 5,000 and he was like that?
No, actually that's what he said after this. I think I don't know if I read it in the book, but that's actually one of the things he said. He said that was one of the things which the doctor was quite surprised about. His body was still warm, which is in cold.
That
I know. I think he didn't get to the position he was aware of his time.
Okay.
His mind was just there. So he was just pissed out. So he didn't get into cessation.
Okay. Then
the
heartbeat
then
can't
stop before. Oh, yes, oh, yeah. Okay. 4 3 hours stops.
The breathing was hard.
Breathing
as well.
The heartbeat was. Could stop. Yeah, because yeah, that could stop as well. I'm not quite sure when, but after 4 times.
So after 4 times, if somebody
has
gone there,
would
they normally come out
of this experience? Oh yeah, remember the mindfulness. The mindfulness hasn't disappeared yet. It's getting less and less as you go through the immaterial journeys.
So awareness and mindfulness
is the same thing. So you're still aware, but you've got hardly anything to be aware of. And so because the object is disappearing, so does the function of mind disappear, of mindfulness. Consciousness needs its object. Consciousness and nama-rupa are like two sheaves, the Buddha said, of reeds which rest upon each other. You take one away, the other one disappears. So you can imagine not taking just a whole sheaf of reeds away, you're taking one straw away and another straw away, and now there's only like 4 straws leaning against each other. That's like, you know, hardly anything left at all. That's the 4th jhana. You take one of those ones away, and there's only 3, and that's the 1st immaterial, and just there's hardly anything left. So consciousness is so refined. You're still aware until you get to the 4th immaterial, and then it's really hard to say whether you're aware or not aware. Neither perception nor non-perception. Things are disappearing. So first of all, the perception of space disappears. Then the perception of consciousness starts to disappear in this 2nd immaterial. And then, when consciousness is disappearing, there's no consciousness left anymore. But then, there's still the perception this consciousness has got. So there's still perception there. So that's why in the next stage, if you look upon it in one direction, you're perceiving it. In another direction, you're not perceiving anything. Consciousness has stopped. It's very, very subtle stages before everything stops. It's just the ceasing of everything. And these are the immaterial states. Now these are incredibly refined, but each one of these, they are called peaceful abidings. Notice the change here? Not pleasant abidings, because all the pleasure, you know, stops in the 4th jhana, but nevertheless it's still pleasurable. It's the pleasure of peace, but a different type of pleasure. But he's talking about the peaceful abidings, because things are disappearing. And the idea of peace, like Sampo, it really means like this, they're quelling down, they're calming, everything is disappearing. So you know, peace is a function of some disappearing. How so peaceful. And all the sound is gone. So peaceful. When all your work is finished, you don't have to go to the work anymore. It's peaceful. You know, when you're finished cooking the meal and washing up afterwards, oh, I have to get some peace now. All peace is cessation of some sort of activity.
city, but with some stability of head, and you go unconscious, you also get the taste of the sexual feeling. So why doesn't he take it?
Number one is because it hasn't been done gradually. And so you haven't actually seen things vanish, stage by stage. You see things vanish stage by stage, you do it very, very slowly. And as you can actually see just how one thing depends upon another. And as one thing is taken away, the other thing ceases. So the whole insight process, for me, this is a gradual cessation, pressure to see, not suddenly. That's what happens here. So, again, the paragraph 11. It's possible here that by complete samadhi on the basis of nothingness, oh, I forgot nothingness. When consciousness has appeared, nothing's left, but you're perceiving nothing. Someone can look on a bias in the face of neither perception nor non-perception. He might think, thus I'm abiding in effacement. But these attainments are not called effacements in another one's discipline. These are called peaceful abidings in another one's discipline. So these, you're not really scratched anything out, although the likelihood of you scratching something out is very important. Because if you've got this graffiti on the wall you're trying to get rid of, getting a bottle of bleach or a bottle of this very strong chemical, you've got the ability to scratch things out. You haven't done it, you've just got the tools, you haven't really done anything yet. There's much more to it than that. So the Buddha is mentioning this because those monks, obviously, it's very common to think because they've got these deep meditations, that's all they need to do. Now, let's say how effacement should be done. Now, Chunda, here effacement should be practiced by you. And this makes it really more down to earth. Others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. Effacement should be practiced us. Others will kill living beings. But we should abstain from killing. Others will take what's not given, but we should abstain from taking what's not given. Others will be uncelibate, we should be celibate. Others will speak falsehood, we should abstain from falsehood. Others will speak maliciously, others will speak harshly. Others will gossip, we should abstain from gossip here. Others will be covetous, we should be uncovetous. Others will have ill will, we should be without ill will. Others will be of wrong view, we should be of right view. As 2 to 10, 2 to 11, those cause the 10 kusala karma pata, the 10 causes of unwholesome actions. So it's much more than the 5 precepts, because we've got the other precepts of malicious speech, harsh speech, and just basically stupid speech. When it says gossip, it doesn't mean if you've seen somebody sort of really misbehaving and you realise that it will be in their best interest, you tell Ajahn Brahm that Kim has got a TV in his room and his kushi. He hasn't got one in there, but just, he said, I better tell Ajahn Brahm because all the monks will be down there next week watching something so quickly. So, it's not real gossip in it, but you tell. Not out of ill will, but out of like kindness. You really think that we could be helping that monk. So each one of these is the tenakusala karma patas, but it starts off with not being poor. And you notice here that it doesn't matter what everybody else is doing. When you say what everybody else does is, that doesn't matter. The effacement, others might be messing around, but I will not.
Does that include internally and externally, or is it externally?
This is mostly externally, except when you get to covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. Because covetousness, that's greed, that's craving. So if you're totally without covetousness, ill will, and without wrong view, you are an arahant. So here it is, it's obviously not meaning that it's not that far yet, but you try and overcome your covetousness and what you want, and your ill will and sort of wrong view. Now, from wrong view, not only it hinges on here, and that's the last of the 10 akusala karma pata, but it's also the first of the eightfold path. Now we get into the eightfold path. Others will be of wrong intention, we should be of right intention here. You remember the 3 right intentions, which are? That's right, yeah. Very good, that's in Pali. What does it mean in English? What's no karma?
renunciation.
Yeah, letting go, making peace with things. Not trying to attain something. Your intention to see how much you can get rid of, not how much you can attain in this retreat. So how many jhanas have you got so far? How many stages of meditation have you got? How much insight have you got? That is the wrong intention. How much can I abandon? How much can I let go of? That's the right intention. How much can I renounce? Inside and outside. And the next one, Hawaiapada, what does that mean? Wayapada means the word, but at Wayapada. Kindness, that's right, yeah. So kindness means metta. So being kind to yourself, being kind to others. And ahimsaka, or ahimsaka sometimes. It means cruelty. Non-cruelty, yeah. In other words, a gentleness to yourself. So those are the three right intentions, and please do that when you meditate. Either we have wrong speech, or should be a right speech here. We already mentioned right speech. There's a lot of overlap in this. But remember, just Buddhism likes to keep repeating things. So, be a wrong speech, we've already mentioned that's wrong speech. Either be a wrong action, we should be a right action here. Either be a wrong livelihood, we should be a right livelihood. In other words, either be a wrong effort, we should be a right effort. We can be a wrong effort. Isn't effort always good?
No.
Isn't it good to get up early in the morning and get out there and just meditate all day? Sit up there and just, doesn't matter what happens. There was this one monk, he was one of the first monks who went to England, and he decided to really keep the Dutang with only having three robes. And so he decided in the winter time to go and sit in meditation all night on Hampstead Heath, just with his three robes. And the next day he was taken to hospital with pneumonia and was there for many days. That's wrong effort. So sometimes the people are stupid for the effort. It's wrong effort is going to sort of harm you. So, but it's also wrong effort if you're just lazy. And just deep down there said, Ajahn Brahm said, do nothing. So you may just get up there in the morning. Said, no, just trying to get up is just desire. And I'm not supposed to, I'm supposed to renounce everything, so I'm going to renounce getting up. No, that's wrong. That's stupidity.
Okay. I think that's
what
this eightfold path, isn't that
so? Yeah, but so. That's right. So unwholesome states disappear, they don't arise in the first place, wholesome states arise and develop. Others will be of wrong mindfulness, we should be of right mindfulness. Others should be of wrong concentration, we should be of right concentration. Hang on, they say we're supposed to have jhanas, we just said that jhanas are not effacement. What's going on here? Because right concentration here, sama samadhi, isn't that jhanas? So this is how you practice effacement. They say this is not effacement. What's the difference here? You see the first paragraph? We just got through the jhanas and the immaterial attainments, the eight of them. They said that's not practicing effacement. So they're saying practicing samadhi is effacement. Others will be wrong concentration, we should be right concentration. Effacement should be practiced thus.
Maybe just
effacement
is wrong.
That's good, the second thing. Where it says, well, concentration here, it still means the sort of samadhi.
Yeah, but here is part of the Eightfold Path, so wisdom goes with it.
Good, excellent. So it's not just standing alone, it's part of it. So you can't excise it from the path, you can't think that that's the whole path and nothing else. So it's the whole path, it's an Eightfold Path, not a Onefold Path. It's not just sati, it's not just samadhi, it's not just right view. Sometimes people do the right view, they just study the books and think that's all they need to do. I've got right view, that's enough. That's a whole lot. And you can see just part of that is sort of other not being cruel. And you've got all these other, oh actually, it's interesting here, through carry on with number 19, others will be of wrong knowledge, wrong vija. We should be of right vija here, others will be of wrong deliverance, we should be of right deliverance here. This is a tenfold path. Where you have from samadhi, we get the knowledge of things as they truly are, and as it's samanyana, and then we get vimutti, deliverance, freedom. Others will be overcome by stop and torpor. We should be free from stop and torpor. Others will be overcome by restlessness. We should be overcome restlessness. Others will be doubters. We should go beyond doubt here. Those are the last three of the five hindrances. Where's the first two hindrances? They're already here. So they're already there. So this is how you practice replacement, by getting rid of the hindrances. Others will be angry. We shall not be angry here. Others will be resentful. We shall not be resentful. Others will be contemptuous. We shall not be contemptuous. Others will be insolent, envious, avaricious, fraudulent, deceitful, obstinate, arrogant, difficult to admonish. Oh, up to that point, we've gone through those actually before. These are some of the things which we've seen in the previous sutras, these bad qualities. Others will be difficult to admonish, will be easy to admonish here. That's really important for monks, because we're supposed to always open ourselves up to admonishment. In 1 month's time, you have a Puavala ceremony, and you're invited to join in that, where you actually say to the Sangha, is there anything you've seen, heard, or suspected which we've done wrong, please let us know. Please admonish us. So you ask, especially if you've got a good friend in the monastery, so look, with everything you've seen, I'll be unmindful, I haven't done the right thing, let me know, in the right way, because then actually you're opening yourself up to some feedback. And you're supposed to be easy to receive feedback, so easy to admonish. You don't, when somebody says, you're sloppy when you're eating, you don't say, I'm sloppy, you should look at you, you're a pig. Who are you to tell me? It will be easy to admonish. And others will have bad friends. We should have good friends. Others will be negligent. We should be diligent. Others will be faithless. We should have faith. Others will be shameless. We should be shameful. Others will have no fear of wrongdoing. We should have afraid of wrongdoing. We're supposed to be afraid. What that really means is this is Hiriyotapa, is the guardians of the world, or guardians of goodness. This means that you understand if you do make a bad karma, you do something wrong, it's going to hurt you. It's the same fear as you'd have of putting a finger in a fire or sort of tickling a snake. You have fear of that, and that's wise fear. Others will be lazy, we'll be energetic here. Others will be unmindful, we should be establishing mindfulness. Others will lack wisdom, we should be possessed of wisdom. Others, and last of all, others will adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty. We should not adhere to our own views or hold on to them tenaciously, but shall relinquish them easily. In other words, if you are in a position you are learning, don't hold on to your own views. Just be open to, especially the advice of other senior teachers. And that's how patience should be practiced. So, what you said earlier, an excellent answer there. It's just the whole package, not just sort of one item in the package. Inclination of mind. Chunda, I say that even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states is of great benefit. So what should be said of body and verbal actions conforming to such a state of mind? In other words, you may not be able to do all of these things, but you should be inclining towards those things. You may fail many, many times, but you're just inclining. You're trying your best, and because you're inclining your best, you'll get there. And the Buddha actually made a point there, if a tree is always inclining to fall on top of the patio, which that one was, that one day it's going to fall on top of that patio. Because they're leaning that way. You've seen it a long time. The patient's going to fall. You know it's going to happen. You can start telling the insurance company that. And if you're always leaning towards, the lack of cruelty and to doing the Eightfold Path, eventually you're going to sort of achieve that. Just what happens? The inclination of a tree. Yes, indeed. They all put also a great benefit of great use. Yeah.
What about the
thing with
the
dip? It has got more chance. You'll incline to landing on the other. You may land on one end many, many, many times on the bad end, but more times it's likely to land on the heavy end. So if you make that end very, very heavy, eventually you're sort of going to land on the heavy end. And the thing is, with enlightenment, you only have to land on the heavy end once of insight.
and then we arrive.
So, the mind should be inclined thus. Others will be cruel, we should not be cruel. Others will be living beings, and as we've done before, all these other ones, we incline to keep the eight precepts. We incline to avoid the ten kusula kamapatas. We incline to get rid of the hindrances. We incline to get rid of these other things like being resentful, angry, and avaricious, etc. We incline to have faith and have good prayers, not to be lazy, etc. And if you're inclined towards those things, others will adhere to their own views, hold on to tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty, but we shall incline not to adhere to our own views, or hold on to them tenaciously, but shall relinquish them easily. As long as you incline towards that, eventually you'll get there. As the mind inclines, so it will reach. Now, avoidance. So, say, but have the aspiration to do it, incline, eventually you'll get there. And this is actually how do you do it? Chumra, suppose there are an uneven path, and another even path to which to avoid it. And suppose there are an uneven fall, another even fall to avoid it. So there is an alternative to the bad actions. So a person given to non-cruelty, given to cruelty, has non-cruelty for which to avoid it. One giving killing living beings has abstention. You know, telling you have an alternative, you don't have to go that one way. You know, you can live a life which doesn't kill living beings, which does not take what is not given. You can live celibate life. You have celibacy as a way to avoid uncelibacy. One given to false speech is abstained from wrong speech to avoid it. One given to malicious speech has abstention from malicious speech. Most of this is abstention. But every now and again you have something which is, for example, one given to wrong view has right view, right speech, right action, right livelihood, to avoid the other things. One knowledge. Okay, one given to doubt has a state beyond doubt, number 23, for which to avoid it. That would be like the stream winner. Most of it is just the opposite here. Arrogance, malignance. Again, one given to making bad friends is making good friends, which to avoid it. One given to negligence has diligence, which to avoid it. Faithlessness has faith, shamelessness has shame. One given to learning little. Oh, I mentioned there a minute. To learn little. It's a learning. So it's important also to have some learning as well. That's why we do Sutta classes. One given to learning, little learning has great learning which to avoid it. One given to laziness has the arousal of energy which to avoid it. One given to mind, unmindfulness has the establishment of mindfulness which to avoid it. One given to lack of wisdom has the acquisition of wisdom to avoid it. And one given to adhere to one's own views or holds on to them tenaciously, even interested with difficulty, has non-adhere to his own views. Not holding on to intonations, you're making some easy for which to avoid it. So there is an alternative, people will say, please of the things.
That was actually very inspiring for me at Metta Vihara, but we didn't just have the eight precepts, but we also had the opposite of practicing it. So sometimes people get the wrong idea, it's just not doing one thing, but also developing the opposite.
And some of those words, like non-cruelty, is actually it's kindness or it's gentleness. There's a very positive thing there. That's why that a long time that people said, you know, what's the opposite of killing? Is actually, you know, being kind. It doesn't mean just making sure you don't step on snails, but actually picking them up and taking them somewhere else. It means also like feeding the cat, you know, looking after the birds, making sure that you have a sense of compassion to all living beings. That's almost the opposite.
Or even saving a life with the knife is in the water or something.
Yeah. What's the opposite of stealing?
Being generous.
Dharma, yes. Mm-hmm. It's opposite. It doesn't mean just I'm not going to steal anything, but I'm going to actually give. Now, what's the opposite of having sex?
Being truthful.
The celibacy one, first of all. Meditation to avoid it.
But also to be reliable.
Reliable, yeah. You have this honesty and reliability instead of like being lying. In other words, you are sort of helping tell the truth and help people out. You don't just keep your mouth shut. You actually help them, say, teach Dharma. Mm-hmm. I'd actually say that's the highest opposite of lying, is teaching truth. Mm-hmm. The highest truth. And the usual one for the opposite of taking alcohol and drugs, because they lead to heedlessness, in fact, is developing mindfulness. So, they say, so the opposite of the fifth precept is developing mindfulness. Obviously, the sixth precept, or eating in the evening.
Right mind food.
Yeah, that's just living simply. It's just renunciation. But that, all the other ones are all about renunciation as well. So that's why there's 6, 7, 8 precepts for renouncing precepts.
Isn't when you say meditation, is that, and that too count as indelicacies?
Yeah, to count as that.
Yeah, the stage 4 path has 500
Sorry?
All this belongs to the 4 path and 500.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So, different ways of saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And now the last one, the way leading upwards, the staircase to heaven and nirvana. Chandra, just as unwholesome states lead downwards, and all wholesome states lead upwards, so too, a person given to cruelty has no cruelty to lead them upwards. This is getting people to understand about life. If they are into attaining things and getting somewhere in life, they get up and get sort of spiritually high. These are the things which one has to do. Now, the way of extinguishing, here we get this paragraph 16, which is often quoted. This is where it comes from, the Salaika Sutta number 8. Chunda, the one who is himself sinking in the mud, to pull out another who is sinking in the mud is impossible. The one who is not sinking in the mud to pull out another who is sinking in the mud, that is possible. So one who is himself untamed, undisciplined, with defilements unextinguished, to tame, even like teach and train another, discipline him and help him extinguish his defilements is impossible. But one who is himself tamed, disciplined, extinguished, should tame another, discipline him and help extinguish his defilements, that is possible. And so that really, people actually say that because whenever the dogmatic Mahayanists, especially those in the Bodhisattva tradition, they keep on saying, oh, don't get in line, you can help a person much better by putting off your own enlightenment and helping other people. And very often the Theravadins actually quote this point. Look, until you are enlightened, at least become a screamer and know what you're talking about, you're stuck in the mud and you just can't help other people. So sometimes the kindest, most compassionate thing to do is you get out in the mud first of all, and then standing on something solid. Like the idea in the paddy fields where this simile comes from. When you're on the dike rather than the muddy field, then you can pull somebody out. So the kindest thing to do is to become enlightened first of all, at least become a screamer now, and then you can go around teaching how to do this.
I don't think there was that story that there was a married monk who had a lot of disciples and many of those became monks, and he got into the same time and then
don't know that, where that story comes from.
The monk came to him and
so it's been over Portillo he's talking about.
Portillo, okay. Oh yeah, that's another one.
They should actually help another.
Well, you're in the mud, you can still sort of give each other a glass of water and pat on the back and just hug each other. But you can't get really out of the mud. So we're saying it to tame a person, to discipline them, to extinguish defilements. So we're talking about this with the deep help.
It doesn't mean you don't do any good karma anymore.
That's right. Just because you're not enlightened doesn't mean you can't help somebody wash the dishes. So you can help. You can extinguish the fire.
It's
a bit nice, that's right, yeah. If you really want to do something, get yourself out of the mud first of all.
So, to overcome the lazy.
Okay, you need someone who's not lazy to inspire you not to be lazy. If everyone else was lazy, then sometimes it's very difficult to do it by yourself. So that's when sometimes the Buddha is saying, if everybody was cruel, you don't have an example of someone who is not cruel. and you have no one sort of standing on the hard bank to actually pull you out of that mud of causing. That's why sometimes good examples, you know, can be hugely helpful. And you know, sometimes you see someone who is incredibly kind, who does some great acts of sacrifice, but you know, it really hurts them, but it doesn't matter, they're going to do something good for somebody else. And that inspires you, and you can then repeat that act. You do these examples, people are out of the mud. And that really helps. So if you find see someone who's really diligent, sometimes that inspires you. Wow, you know, this person is doing so, I'm going to be okay as well. I'm going to sort of be more diligent. So a person given to cruelty has non-cruelty to bother to extinguish it. This is to extinguish it, of actually to inspire to extinguish it. One given to killing living beings has someone who abstains from these things to inspire them to extinguish it, and all the other 45 factors. One given to adhere to his own views, who holds on to them tenaciously and links them with difficulty, has not adhered to one's own views, not holding on to them tenaciously and links them easily, voice to extinguish it. Seeing that in somebody else inspires you. Maybe that's what that means. So, Chunda, the way of effacement has been taught by me. The way of inclining the mind has been taught by me. The way of avoidance has been taught by me. The way leading upwards has been taught by me. And the way of extinguishing has been taught by me. So this is a common feature of the Buddha's talk to inspire monks or nuns, lay people. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion on them? I have done for you. So I've done my part, I've taught Dhamma. There are these roots of trees, these empty abidings, not empty huts. Meditate, Chunda. Do not delay, or else you regret it later. This is our instruction to you. This is what the Blessed One said, Devanam Mahachunda was satisfied and delighted with the Blessed One's words. Now when it says Mahachunda, you know, he was one of the great disciples, you know, he wasn't actually, the Buddha was not really talking to him, or really the people who Chunda actually brought towards him, to him. Because usually the Buddha would just address the senior most person there.
But why does he say this is our instruction? The instruction of the Buddha? Sorry.
Yeah, that's just the way of, like almost like the royal we in English.
Oh.
You know, they don't say I, they say us. Why the Queen Elizabeth always says.
We're not moved.
That's right, we're not moved. Okay, so that is the one about effacement. Just to start that up again. Actually, the purpose of monastic life is actually to get rid of the defilements, to become enlightened, actually to relinquish all these things. And to do that, that's called effacement. And you go back to the very beginning again, to see this. Chunda, as those views that arise in the world associated with doctrines of a self, with doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to which those views arise, which they underlie, which they exercise upon, if seen as the attributes of core wisdom, this is not mine, this I'm not, this is not myself. That's how the abandoning and relinquishing of those views comes about. And to be able to abandon those, this is me, this is mine, sorry, to be able to see and realize all this stuff is not me, not mine, not the self, that's how we have to do this effacement. To see it, not me, not mine, not the self. Just the whole Eightfold Path. Get rid of the five hindrances, the ten karma paths, the akusala. Karma paths we avoid, the ten causes of unwholesome action, keep your precepts, abandon such things as being instant, contemptuous, deceitful, obstinate and stuff like that. And when that whole path is actually practiced, and also, I missed it out before, about not being of little learning, be of great learning, so study is important, it's part of it here. And then, if you do all of that, the whole package, then effacement happens, you see all these things, this is not me, this is not mine, not our self, and thereby the views of the self and the world are totally abandoned, then you are the streamer. So that's how you efface the wrong views of that world. You scratch them out, once and for all. Any questions about that? Okay, we are done. Coming next week. next Saturday will be